There's no way a writer becomes a topic of a 90-minute podcast without having an artfully crafted legacy, and Ted Hughes is clearly no different. But so much of Hughes's legacy is tied up with another literary giant, his first wife, the late Sylvia Plath. What does it mean to begin crafting a legacy while you're still alive? And a legacy that no matter how hard you work and how many awards you win, does not fully belong to you. I discuss this with my guest, Professor Emily Van Dyne, the author of the upcoming book, Loving Sylvia Plath, from W.W. Norton, out next year.
It's so strange to probably people who are clicking on this to hear like a hate fest about Ted Hughes, that like we've both been like sympathetic to him and mostly talking about Sylvia Plath, because like, again, like their lives were so inextricably linked for so long, and the specter of her followed him for literally the rest of his life, which was long. He lived for another, 50 years after her
35,
death?
35, yeah. He was 68 when he died. He died of cancer. But yeah, that's a long time, 35 years after Plath's death. And then, of course, you know, he ends up really appointing himself the sort of custodian of her work. So he becomes her editor, and he becomes, in some ways, her publisher, because he's got so much influence on the people that are publishing her. Right. And at least in the late 60s and early to mid 70s, he and his sister, who is a literary agent and who became the agent for Plath's estate, and she was a TV too. Alwyn.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
They were quite a team. They had a series of like limited edition, small press stuff that they would put out, with the Rainbow Press was one. And so, you know, they are responsible for, in many ways, the world's understanding of Sylvia Plath. But what's amazing is that from everything that I've read, which is a lot, and I've read a lot of unpublished stuff in archives too, every time there's a new Plath biography or anything new by Plath comes out, whether it's about her or by her, they keep thinking they can control the story. Right. And that's what I am so riveted by, because they're like, this will be the one that gets it back, you know? And it's like, it never does. Like, the story is out. It's run away from you, you know? The more they try to suppress facts, the wilder the mythology becomes.
It's so true. The way it feels is like he is both out for self-preservation and preservation of this woman that he's starting to like mythologize after a certain time, because she really did change the way he wrote and he approached poetry, in the same way that like he really felt like he was sort of her tutor in and he urged her to break through in another way. And so whenever I mentioned that I was going to be talking about Ted Hughes on Twitter, a bunch of people just kind of would chime in, and they would be like, well, you know, really violently angry towards Ted Hughes. And I'm like, I both fully understand, because like, I would not want to be married to him or in a relationship with him in any way, shape or form. He was a monster.
He was not a good partner.
Mm-hmm. No. But at the same time, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of vitriolic hate towards him in a way that I'm not sure if people know him as anything other than just like the man who stifled Sylvia Plath.
Yeah. I should be clear. Like, I don't feel that kind of vitriol. I think the more you learn about somebody, the less you're able to feel that kind of vitriol. Like, I like to make snarky jokes, but like, what I find fascinating is, and this is sort of like par for the course with like discourse about white men.
Right.
Is like, I'll make like a snarky Ted Hughes joke, and then people are like, my God, like the man, you know? And it's like, okay, he's been dead for 20 plus years. Yeah. And like, it's a joke. Don't, guys, you know, cool down. But I think that it's partly his fault, right? Because as I said, like, the more you appear to be hiding, the more people want to know, and the angrier people become. And the truth is that he did cover up a lot of things, and not just about Sylvia Plath. So one of the women that he was having an affair with, Assia Webble, that was, of course, part of the reason that his marriage to Plath tanked. And then they were together. He was seeing other women the whole time, and she was married, I think, until 1966, but they were together pretty much from 1963 to 1969. They had a daughter, Shura. And when Assia ended her life, she also killed their daughter.
Yeah.
And that was in 1969. And so, you know, he really, really went out of his way to get people to not talk about that.
Yeah.
And a lot of people were very influenced by him because he was enormously famous and quite powerful in Britain, particularly, less so in America.
Yeah.
He's very beloved in many corners of Britain, or the UK generally. And so he also, you know, disregarded her final wishes. He had her and Shura cremated, and then he either buried or scattered their ashes, or no one knows, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no grave. No one knows where they're buried or where their ashes are. She was Jewish. She, her family fled Hitler's Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So cremation is also against the Jewish tradition. I mean, yeah. There's a lot that's very wrong with the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, we really didn't know that generally until it started to come out when there was a biography of Assia that was published in the early 2000s. Called Lover of Unreason.
That recent.
So it was a long time, you know, and she was misnamed if she was discussed at all. Like there's a book called Bitter Fame that the Hughes family, I have it right here actually.
Yeah.
And well, podcast listeners can't see, but here's Emily's looking at the cover. This is the only quote unquote authorized biography of Plath and the Hughes estate, or the Plath estate, which was run by the Hughes, authorized it. But Assia is barely spoken about in that. And it was published in the late 80s. At one point in one biography, she was referred to as, I think, Olga.
Oh.
Her father was Russian or of Russian descent. So, you know, when it started to come out, I think people really felt like, my goodness. And plus, there is something pretty horrifying about a man who had two women in their lives. I mean, that's, you do wonder.
Yeah. I mean, the way Hughes interacts with his legacy while he's alive is very distasteful in a way that like he, I don't know quite how to say this, like the truth, again, like being in a relationship with two women who died by suicide is just a parade of red flags. Like clearly there's something, either he's attracted to women with that sort of mental illness or volatility, or he inspires that sort of mental illness and volatility. Both of those things could easily be argued. And at the same time, like the trauma of him experiencing that in the mid-century where men are not really expected to be affected by things, or psychoanalysis for men non-existent, him also being a manly man, rugged, you know, individual sort of thing, certainly probably had an effect on him. It's a tacky phrase to use, but like it's a perfect storm of terribleness that is existing in this man's life and his poor children.
It is definitely a perfect storm of terribleness. I agree with you. But then at the same time, you know, he marries this woman, Carol Orchard. Like
poor Carol. Oh my God, poor Carol.
A minute after Assia dies, and he's also having an affair with a third woman named Brenda Hedden, and who knows.
And you had mentioned that he referred to them as A, B, and C. Just like, how do I make up my mind between these three women in my life, A, B, and C? Like Assia, Brenda, and Carol.
Yeah, and his children
are like, a minor for a lot of this as well.
She was under 18 for a good part of this. Yeah, I mean, I think this is part of what I mean with like Hughes. People were unaware of this. I mean, it didn't really get covered until Bates' biography, which came out in 2014. And so, you know, if you've been told sort of by your teachers or by the general culture, by whoever, oh, you know, he was a wonderful person and those women were crazy. And then you read this, it's like, I don't know, man. I think there's something to be said for, and this is a big part of how I hope we can change the conversation. He was mentally ill, clearly, right? He was
clearly
suffering from like very serious depression, manic phases.
PTSD,
And I think that in the summer and fall of 1962, which is when his marriage to Plath blows up, he seems to be going through some kind of manic phase. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. She, in some of her writing, is describing the things he's saying to her. And then he writes letters at the same time, which back up her claims, right? Where, you know, he says, like, there's a dictator inside of me, and like, I'm going to leave you, and I'm going to win the Nobel Prize, and, you know, I'm going to be a film director. And then that's other thing that comes up with him that, and if you read his unpublished letters in archives, like he's always got these mad schemes.
Yeah.
Really odd, right? Yeah. Because, no, Ted, man, like you're already like one of the most famous poets on the earth. Like, why don't you just go with that?
Yeah, live with that. It's good. Yeah. Settle. It's okay.
Okay, you know? And then like, I have a joke with my best friend from college because she was in at Emory with me the last time I was there in the archives. And, you know, we read this letter where he's like, I'm writing an island comedy. My island comedy is going to be. And so like Danny and I are always like, oh, how's your island comedy going? You know, it's like ludicrous. Or like write film scripts. And
he reminds me so much of Ernest Hemingway in so many different ways. Like I have an absolute fascination with Hemingway because he's just so bananas. Mm-hmm. Again, welcome to my incredibly non-intellectual discussions of literature. But he's so obsessed with masculinity and virility and sex. I think probably one could make the argument that he is a sex addict as well. Well, like there's
so either Hemingway or both.
I both, think both everyone like a both. Lot of lionized men in Western yeah. literature just like seem to have a lot of the same characteristics. And in a way that makes it them very distasteful for modern times, but also like incredibly perfect for the time in which they raised to fame.
That's a really great way to put it. I think, you know, it and Plath, nobody celebrated Hughes's virility more than Plath. Yeah. I mean, really and truly in her journals and her letters, you know, she writes these encomiums to his banging virility, you know, and his poems that bang crash and, you know, yeah. all that stuff. And she's really interested in finding somebody who is her physical, intellectual, psychological, emotional match, right? Mm-hmm. She feels like every other man she's been with, there's some part of her that she has to hold back in order to be with that man. And then finally she meets Ted Hughes and she doesn't have to hold anything back. Yeah. And so, you know, that's incredibly attractive. Plus, like, I mean, I just wrote about this in my Sylvia Plath newsletter. Like, if you look at images of Plath and Hughes from when they met,
they're gorgeous.
They're gorgeous. It's like absurd. I mean, yeah. Hughes, I had read a bunch of biographies of Plath when I was in high school and sort of didn't notice. And then I think I was about 20 and I started like thumbing through the photographs. I'm like, my heavens, this is a handsome man. You know?
He's a babe. Listen to the rest of this episode by becoming a patron at patreon.com/fuckboysoflit. A subscription of just $1 opens up this and dozens of other episodes. We'll be back next week.